Former WDEO reporter Kelly Tyrell ran over 100 miles in under 30 hours at the Superior Trail Race in Minnesota last weekend. Now a science writer at the University of Wisconsin, I had a chance to speak with Kelly after she returned to Madison following the race about her journey into ultramarathoning and how she overcame many obstacles, including one in just the opening 2 hours of the race, to find one of the hardest finish lines an athlete can cross. As someone who ran marathons, when did you decide that you wanted to do more than 26.2, and why did you make that decision?
It wasn't so much a decision as maybe peer pressure. A good friend of mine in Delaware, Liz Jones, bought me a book on ultramarathoning and sent it to me and said, hey, let's do one of these. I'll come to Wisconsin and we can run one. And so that was kind of the genesis of it. I had run a lot of marathons at that point and shorter races, a lot of road races, and I was really interested personally in spending more time on trails and enjoying more of the journey of running instead of just the pursuit of the finish line. And so it came at a good time, and I trained based on the book that she sent me and had a really great experience, and that was in 2015.
So what is the journey of running, and how is it different than somebody who's like, all right, I want to run the Delaware Marathon?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the nice things about running is that, everybody is pursuing the same activity, but maybe their reasons are a little bit different or their individual experience is a little bit different. For me, running road races is satisfying from the perspective of I know I can train and I can hone that training and really get myself on that fine sort of nice edge of doing, just enough to train my body to perform at a high level for my own sake, my own personal high level, to go out and do a race to try to achieve my personal best. And that means lining up at the start line, putting all of that training to work, running as fast as I can for whatever the duration of that event is, and then getting to the finish line. And, really everything that happens from start to finish is kind of a blur because the intensity is fairly high and, you're really focused on just getting to the end. Whereas I feel like for me, ultramarathoning is more about the experience of actually being out and moving on the trail. It's about the other people that I'm sharing the trail with, the conversations that we have, the camaraderie that we build because we're having this shared experience. It's about being outdoors. It's about being in the wilderness. It's about moving my body over unpredictable terrain. And so getting to the finish line as quickly as you can is still the goal, but there's so much more that happens along the way. And I think that the longer you go, so the longer your race or the longer it takes, so the more opportunity you have for that kind of journey. And it's a journey that is both physical, but it's very sort of mental and sometimes spiritual as well.
In what way do you feel that it's spiritual?
It is my time to sort of reflect, I think, to be inside my own head, to be inside my own body. But also, while I'm there, I'm moving through the world. And so there's a connection between me and the terrain and the space that I'm moving through. And so in some ways, it feels like a spiritual journey in that I do feel very connected to my surroundings. There's a fluidity sometimes that you find that I find on the trail, and I feel like I grow from that fluidity sometimes, that connection.
So when you ran the first race with Liz, obviously you finished. What made you then want to do more and go further?
Sure. I'm going to say a little bit selfishly that I actually won that first race. It was a 50K. It was a relatively easy trail, so that it wasn't very technical. There was not altitude or extreme elevation. And I just showed up anticipating, my first event longer than a marathon. And I was very successful at it. I got to stand on a podium, and that was really rewarding. And that was the kind of success I wasn't really seeing in road races. So there's, I'm sure, an element of that competitive nature and the reward of winning. But I realized that what I had sort of been seeking was that more trail time, that more sort of feel of adventure. I really did find that in that first race. And it wasn't, I would say 50K didn't feel all that challenging coming from a marathoning background. It was only a little bit longer than a marathon, which I know sounds kind of ridiculous, but But that was my personal experience of it. And so from there, it felt like a gateway into other kinds of ultra marathoning experiences. Once I had that under my belt, I decided I wanted to go do a mountain race. And so I found a 50-mile race that was out in Colorado. And that was a totally different kind of challenge. And so it did sort of open a window into totally new experiences and new ways of challenging myself that I hadn't really encountered before.
Well, I know in our conversations the couple of weeks before you ran that first 50-miler, there were nerves that I don't remember hearing from you in the past. Obviously, I didn't know you when you started the journey. But what were the things you were worried about when you went from relatively flat trail to all of a sudden in Colorado and Utah? And yeah, the distance is something, but now I've got to worry about elevation as well.
That was a large part of it. I didn't know how my body would respond to being at altitude. The race that I chose spent a lot of time above tree line. It ended up at the halfway point above 13,000 feet. I was very exposed. So I knew going in that there were all of these challenges that I had never confronted before. I've backpacked and I've spent time in mountains and been at altitude, but it's a different experience when you're moving quickly or not doing sort of the gradual sleeping at altitude and adjusting. It was all in one shot. And so it was a big unknown for me. On top of that, there was a good chance that I could go off trail and have to find my way back. And so I actually studied a little bit of basic orienteering ahead of my race so that I could get myself back onto a trail if I went off. And there was a very large possibility of storms. That part of the country in the summertime, this took place right around the solstice, the summer solstice. And in that part of the country, in the mountains, thunderstorms are a routine. And so there was a chance that I'd have to, actually deliberately get myself off trail to take cover. And so there were all these added elements. It wasn't just about completing a distance or finding that finish line. It was also about, keeping myself safe while I was out there, and because I had no idea really what to anticipate, I had a lot of nerves.
So you end up successful at that, and then ultimately through injuries, you end up with 100 as the goal. What did 100 miles represent to you, and why did that become a race that you wanted to focus on?
So when I started ultramarathoning, every distance was new. Checked off 50K, I did 50 mile, but I did 50 mile in the mountains. I hadn't done 50 mile not in the mountains, and so that was a new opportunity. And I thought to myself through most of that time, I would never want to run more than 50 miles. More than that just seems really far. 100 miles seems crazy. And I still actually think that, having completed my first 100 miler. But I had run a really successful 50-mile race last August in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, where I was able to set the course record by 59 minutes. And that was an empowering experience. And I had a lot of people say to me, oh, the Superior 100 is a couple of weeks away. It's very similar terrain. You should email the race director and see if you could do it. You could totally do it. And I thought, no, I don't really want to do that. I guess I'm getting a little ahead of myself. I did have that race, and I did email the race director, and it was too close to the race. I had, though, entered the lottery for that race earlier in the year, in part because I learned that the Superior 100 takes place right around my birthday. And so there was sort of a novelty to that, to the idea of running the longest distance I could fathom. At the same time that I was entering a new year of life. And so I had entered the lottery earlier in the year and didn't get in. Then I went to the Marquette 50-miler and set the course record. And that prompted other people to convince me to try and get in. And it didn't happen last year, but I did enter the lottery again this year and was fortunate enough to be accepted into the race. And it started the day before my birthday and ended on my birthday. And for me, that was kind of a meaningful experience and probably what drew me to the race most prominently.
As you're stepping up in the distances, and we'll get to the race here in a minute, but
How do you go about going through the steps? What do you have to do to build the training? Anyone who's done the Couch to 5K knows what, you know, what that's like, or trying to build to a half marathon or a marathon. Try to explain this going for 100 miles, or for that matter, even a 50 miler.
Yeah, there's something, most people don't start off ultra marathoning, right? Most people start with a 5K, 10K. They might build up to a half marathon, a marathon. They'll do that for a while. Ultra marathoning is really about the long game, I think. I have more than 10 years of running accumulated at this point in my life. And so, you know, my training looks different than somebody who's maybe approaching shorter distances or even longer distances for the first time. So I kind of have the benefit of a body that is well equipped to handle distance. And I think the way that I did it by, you know, starting with a 50K and then I kind of threw myself into a hard 50 miler, and that went okay. And I did a couple of, I would say, easier ones, even though that kind of sounds silly, but easier 50 milers for a while. I built up a really solid fitness base. So, you know, in my off season, I'm probably running 40 to 45 miles a week, which is what many people might reach as their peak week for marathoning. But that's what I'm doing sort of in my off season. And then the rest of the year, I'm building up to higher mileage. I haven't been higher than about 76 miles in a single week. But I combine that with some cross training, cycling, rock climbing. But also cycling through maybe shorter distance races as a way to train. And so those become good opportunities to get my mind and my body prepared for something like 100 miles. I didn't actually do more overall weekly mileage to train for 100 miles. I focused a lot more on specific training for the terrain, trying to make sure that I was ready for rocks and roots. And I probably slowed down a little bit because I knew that my race was not going to be that fast. And I really worked on my power hiking because you have to utilize a lot of that in a smart race. But I didn't modify my training too much relative to my regular, but it's still probably a lot more than most people would be accustomed to. And I wouldn't advise anybody just kind of going 0 to 70 in a single training cycle.
One more pre-question here. In terms of, you're talking about these long training runs, how in the world do you balance doing, because obviously each training run, if I'm doing a 30-minute training run for a 5K or a 10K, that's got to be so much longer when you're at the longer distances. How do you balance that with being a working professional? I know in your case, you know, multiple jobs with freelancing as well.
Yeah, part of it is just to have a lot of energy. I guess I'm blessed to have that. Something I should add to my training is that I end up doing back-to-back long runs. So I will stack long runs together, which is maybe not something you would do typically training for 5, 10K, half marathon, marathon. For me, you know, it requires a lot of balance. I have had to be pretty strict about my sleep because that's an easy thing for me to kind of let fall by the wayside. I'll find myself getting to bed way too late and only getting 4 or 5 hours, and then I start getting sick and breaking down. And so, you know, I've really had to be diligent about ensuring I'm getting 6-7 hours of sleep during the week, trying to aim for 8 hours on the weekends when I can. Otherwise, I've really tried to make running a part of my lifestyle. So that might mean running to and from work. So using running as my commute, that saves me that amount of time during the day. You know, I'm already spending it commuting by bike or by bus anyway. I might as well do it on my own 2 feet and get my training in. Sometimes that means doing 2 runs a day, whether that's a run in the morning and then I run again at lunch, or I run again after work, or I combine a commute to and a commute from. It means making running part of my social life. So that's where I catch up with a lot of my friends. We'll go for runs and catch up. I really had to have running become an integral part of my life and not sort of a separate piece of it. And it does mean, you know, sometimes asking for understanding from friends, you know, when I can't stay out as late, or I can't be up as early, or, you know, I have to go get my run in before I can meet them for something, so I'm showing up a little bit later maybe than others might be. It also helps that my husband is an endurance athlete, and so He's either out running with me or he's out doing long bike rides. And so, you know, we're not competing for one another's time, but we often try to find opportunities to use our physical activity to spend time together. I'll give an example. Recently, I did a training run, and he decided, and I drove to the trail, and he decided he would ride his bike to a brewery, and then we would meet there afterward. And so, you know, while we weren't spending time together during our respective training pursuits, we did use that as an opportunity to find common time together afterward. It's really just, it's trying to balance as much as I can and not let too much guilt seep in when I can't fulfill every social obligation and, you know, balancing my other responsibilities as well.
Take me to the start line now at Lake Superior. After all the training, what goes through your mind in those final minutes before the beginning of the end of this journey, if you will?
I was pretty surprised, actually. For probably the first time, I didn't feel a lot of anxiety at the start line. And I don't have a real good explanation for that, other than I'd been trying to work on some mindfulness ahead of time and really being present. And so when I was at the start line, I was really just focused on what the start line environment was like, who was there, who was lined up. The course record holder was there, and she had a big smile on her face. And she's a woman that I met a few years ago, and I was excited for her. She was going for her fifth attempt at a win on the course, which would have broken the win streak record. Another good friend of mine was also at the start line, and so we were able to sort of chat and catch up, and we ran the first few miles together as well. It was, for me, more of a culmination of the work and the stress that had brought me to there. It was very stressful preparing for the race and getting all of the logistics right, and ensuring that my support crew was prepared and felt equipped to help, and also in a position to take care of themselves while they were also taking care of me, because I did not want anybody to get hurt or injured or sick on account of me just because they'd signed up to help. So by the time I was at the start line, I think I was feeling pretty ready to just to accept whatever was to come. I mean, it's such a big task. I mean, running 100 miles, my brain still can't fathom that. My brain cannot wrap its head around. I can't wrap my own head around going 100 miles all in one shot. And so, you know, my focus became more on just starting and the next step and the next step and each step after that. And, you know, the real anticipation came when I was trying to just plan ahead for aid stations, or if I needed to change my shoes or shuffle things around in the pack that I was carrying. But otherwise, I really just tried to stay in the present moment.
So you do all the preparation and think about all the potential pitfalls, and then you guys all run into a beehive?
Yeah, so every year on the Superior Hiking Trail, people run into ground nesting bees. I don't know if they're bees or they're wasps, but they're stinging insects. And, you know, and that's just something that race organizers had warned everybody about. They actually recommended or required that anybody with an allergy carry an EpiPen. So we knew that it was possible, but, you know, the pre-race dinner the night before, the race director had people raise their hands if they'd been stung by bees before, and it was maybe 20% of the crowd. I feel like that was not the experience Friday going into Saturday, where it seems like most people were stung this year. But it was funny because we had just done a water crossing, and we were at mile 7, and my shoelace came untied. And so I had been sort of in a group of runners at that point, and I pulled aside to tie my shoe, and the group passed me. And then I heard all of this hollering coming from the woods ahead of me, and I went, oh, there must be an exciting part of the course coming up. Well, it turns out that excitement was ground nesting bees. As runners had gone through before them, and as this group had gone through, it had riled them up, and they swarmed. And, of course, at this point, I'm coming through solo because I'd pulled off to tie my shoe, so I'm an easy target. And, yeah, I got stung, at least 5 times.
How do you try to keep yourself calm? Because I feel like if you panic, I mean, you've only got so much energy you can put into 103.3, and all of a sudden you've got to burn a little bit of this on, uh-oh, now what do I do?
That, Sean, that's exactly what went through my head was, I'm 7 miles into a 103-mile race. I cannot burn energy right now. So I really had to use some of that mindfulness to, you know, assess the situation to make sure, okay, I'm not having a reaction. I'm not swelling up badly. I'm not in a situation where I have to seek medical attention. So, like, keep my breathing calm and just accept the fact that this was uncomfortable, but is not a game changer.
What was the strongest point of the 100 for you, and what was the weakest part of the 100 for you?
I probably felt strongest in the first 30 miles. I was running most of the course. I was hiking the steep sections, as most people were. I was really enjoying the vistas, though the race is on the North Shore of Minnesota, which probably most people in the country would not think of as very rugged or very tough terrain. It turns out it's really challenging terrain. Over the course of my 100 miles, we had 21,000 feet of elevation gain and then 21,000 feet of elevation loss. There was virtually no flat section of the course. And so, you know, it was a very physically trying race, but it's also gorgeous. You come up these, what they call their mountains. They're not mountains, they're these high bluffs. But you come up high and you overlook Lake Superior or some of the smaller lakes that are in the region, and it's just really stunning. And especially this time of year, some of the trees are starting to turn, so you're getting this really beautiful fall color, and you're kind of propelled along by the energy of all the other runners. At that point, most of us were still relatively packed close together. I mean, it's not a, you know, you're not stumbling over one another, but you're close enough that you're having conversation and sharing the experience. And so I probably felt strongest then. My lowest point was probably in the dead middle of the night, probably, you know, between 1:30 and 3:30 in the morning, 4 in the morning, where I couldn't see anything anymore. It was dark. I had my headlamp in, and I had a friend pacing me, so he was running alongside me to help keep me safe and on task. But the course got really steep, and, you know, even with headlamps, there were a lot of shadows, and the terrain was really rocky, it was really rooty, and I remember having a conversation with him at that point, not feeling sorry for myself or anything, but just matter-of-factly saying, you know, I don't think I need to do one of these again. This is really hard. My legs hurt. Really, I just kind of wanted to go sit down. And so, so then around 4 in the morning, I got into the aid station where I was trading that pacer off for another friend who picked up pacing from there. And I did get to sit down, and I ate a little bit of food, and I changed into a dry shirt because it had rained and I'd sweated. And then I got up and got moving, and the terrain changed. It was a little bit tamer, and I could do a little bit more running again, which was uplifting. And then the sun started to come up, and that really just kind of changed my whole mindset again. You know, it felt different to be running in the daylight, even though I still wasn't, you know, my legs still felt tired, but they weren't as painful as they had been earlier in the race around mile 60, mile 70. And I got to a section of the course that I just absolutely loved. There was a beautiful river, and the trails widened out a little bit and smoothed over, so the running itself ended up becoming a little easier for a stretch. So that's probably where I kind of had my second wind or felt strong again, even though I was being very careful about my footing. It kind of felt good to kind of pass through that hard point and emerge on the other side.
You mentioned the aid station. Obviously, you need to intake calories knowing how many you burn during the course of the race. I got to believe it's in the five figures. What types of food are you eating? What are you drinking to help you survive this ultimate test of your body?
That's a great question. This race didn't have as exciting of aid station food as I've encountered in the past. Some of my favorite foods include macaroni and cheese, avocados, Nutella, salted watermelon. But this particular race, I was eating a mix of sort of prepackaged energy foods, you know, your standard like Cliff Bar foods and things like that. I was eating these energy chews, the honey stinger chews, and after a while I got totally sick of those. I had packed a whole bunch in drop bags so I could pick up more along the course at the aid stations. And after a certain point I said, nope, none of these. I left them in all my bags. But at aid stations in general, I would eat like potatoes dipped in salt, or watermelon or quesadillas. I had a half of a grilled cheese sandwich and some hash browns at one aid station. I'm not a meat eater, but people were eating bacon and sausages. There were broths at one station. I was doing a lot of veggie broth because that's a good way to get enough salt along with some calories. And a little bit of savory flavor, because one of the problems with a lot of the packaged foods is they're very sugary, and after a while, your body just doesn't want sugar. It wants the fat, it wants the protein, it wants the things that are not as easy to get. So I also did have some, like, trail butter or nut butters in sort of single-use packaging that I ate, and that seemed to treat me well. Beverage-wise, I mostly stuck to water, although one of my favorite things to do in a race that I never do in real life is to drink soda. Especially for a good caffeine boost, particularly in the middle of the night. So I was drinking a lot of soda at aid stations and then water as I carried it in between.
So as you're moving along the course, was there a mile marker that said 100 at some point? And can you take me through, as someone who has run probably thousands of 5Ks in your life, what this final 5K was like?
It was the worst. The final 5K was the worst. I guess I would say that was probably my lowest low point. I don't feel like I had really a low point, but in thinking back, you know, it was that 60-mile mark, but then at the very end. So the last aid station was about 7 miles from the finish. So I knew in my mind, okay, I have 7 miles to go. I've been 96 already, and it's just 7 miles. But at the pace that I was moving, I knew that was not, you know, just a simple hour. That was going to be a couple of hours still out on the trail. And, you know, whereas in all the miles preceding it, I was able to stay pretty focused on the present, knowing there was a lot ahead. Suddenly, I knew how much there was. There was something I could quantify, I could hold in my hand, 7 miles. And it was both close, short, but far. And that part of the course was particularly challenging because you have to do these two big climbs in order to get out and down into the finish line area, which finishes in this ski resort town on the north shore of Minnesota called Lutzen. And so we had to kind of come out of the mountainous part. And it was these two really steep, like Appalachian Trail-like sections where you just climb and climb and climb through this forested region, and you don't ever get a good view of where you're headed. So there's no way to know what you have in front of you. And so that last, I would say, you know, the last mile and a half was great because it came out onto a logging road and then onto road. And so I had a sense of where I was going and that there was an end in sight. And I ran that whole section. So that felt good to be able to run the very last few miles or last mile and a half of such a long event. But immediately preceding that is probably the only time on the course that I started to feel bad for myself. I started to feel sorry for myself because I really just wanted to be done.
You've crossed so many finish lines in your life. You've done the 250 milers in 2016, the 100K earlier in the year. How was this finish line different?
This finish line felt like it was more hard won than any finish line I've encountered in my life. And that's despite, you know, confronting injury and making it to races despite minimal training and thinking that I might not get there. This finish line was really the culmination of a journey. But unlike a lot of these other races that I've done in the past where I might have, you know, maybe one person supporting me, it's usually my husband, I had a team of people who had been at my side since at least the halfway mark. You know, not literally at my side, sometimes literally, but for the most part, I mean, they were showing up at the aid stations for me and making sure that I was eating and getting the things out of my bags that I needed and taken care of. And they were rotating between also running with me for short stretches of the race. Well, short, relatively speaking. One friend paced me for 20 miles, another friend paced me for 18, another friend paced me for 13, and my husband spent 7 of that 13 also with us. And so, like, getting to the finish line was more of a shared experience for me because it was the whole team, right? They were working so hard to get me there, and so they got to share in that finish line experience with me, and that was really meaningful in a way that I didn't anticipate going into it. I really appreciated the people who had offered their support in the first place, and I just really didn't expect to feel that shared sense of accomplishment. And I crossed the finish line and just burst into tears. I mean, full-on ugly crying, just because I was overcome with all of the emotion of that shared experience of being overwhelmed, of being exhausted, of being relieved, of being just so proud of the journey that I took. Because one of the things about doing a race of that magnitude is you don't know if you're going to finish, right? You never have guarantees, but you can feel relatively sure that you can finish a 5K. Even if it gets hard and you have to walk, you can still finish it. It's going to take you a little bit longer, but it's still, you know, maybe 45 minutes instead of, you know, 25 minutes. But, you know, with something like 100 miles, you just don't know. Anything could happen at any time, and you go into that experience knowing that. And that's probably part of the appeal, right, is there's no guarantee of certainty. And so crossing that finish line meant that with all of that uncertainty for all of those hours, I was able to make it happen. And there I was. I'd arrived.
How do you feel like this whole experience has changed you as a person?
I can say that I feel very mellow right now, and I don't know if that's just because I'm tired and haven't recovered yet. It did require a lot of patience, and so maybe it taught me something about patience. You know, certainly reinforced the value of teamwork and mutual support. There were so many people out there who weren't specifically there to support me, but what we're offering it, from the volunteers of the aid stations to the crew members of other people I knew out on the course who recognized me and offered me help. There's just a generosity there. You know, none of those people need to be there. This is a silly endeavor. It's not meaningful in the big grand scheme of life. And yet, you know, here we all were sharing the experience and you know, I was able to take advantage of people's generosity. So, you know, I think in some ways it really has inspired me to do more volunteering at races myself, because I'd really like to help other people have the same experience, or at least a good experience, to the extent that I can, and to show the value to give the value back to the community that I experienced at the race.
If you're going to run for 29 hours and 50 minutes, needless to say, unless you're running in Alaska at the solstice, it's going to be dark. What are the challenges, and how do you go about overcoming running, you know, when you can't necessarily see what's in front of you?
Yeah, so you need a headlamp. For one, you need to provide some kind of ambient light. But I think, as I mentioned earlier, that creates shadows. And on a really rocky and ridgy course like the one I was on, it made footing sort of tenuous at times. You're also tired. I mean, our bodies are set to rhythms called circadian cycles. And, you know, we're programmed to get sleepy at night and go to bed and then wake up with the sun. And that's not something that you can do while you're moving forward. So, you know, you have to kind of make this consciously unconscious decision to just keep going despite the signals that your body's sending you to shut down and curl up and go to sleep. One of the neat things about that is, you know, few of us spend time in wilderness or on trail at 3 a.m. And so you get the experience of different quality of sound and light that you don't have other times. And so it's sort of a window into a world that most of us don't spend time in. And then, you know, the sort of awakening that happens in your mind and body as the sun comes up is pretty unique as well.
Is that just a, can you describe what that sunrise is like when you do see that first natural light?
Yeah, in my particular race, my pacer, Stacy, and I had just come up this steep rise, and we were up on one of those bluffs again, and we could see for the first time in for me, hours and hours and hours, Lake Superior, which is a huge lake. It's right, the largest inland lake on our continent. And there was just a little hint of sunlight, sunrise coming up over the lake. And it was just I guess a feeling of elation is the best way to describe it, because I hadn't seen anything for so long, and then here was this lake and the sunshine, and realizing that birds were coming out and insects were starting to buzz again, and I was feeling less fatigued than I had before, and feeling more optimistic about the hours that I still had in front of me.
You're a science journalist. What's the biggest thing that Kelly Tyrell, the science journalist, has learned through all of this?
You know, there's something to be said for confronting challenges and having that patience. I think as a science writer, you know, there are things that come up in day-to-day life that are hard, that are frustrating. And I think that this experience, along with the others that I've had to this point, but really reinforced here, just shows me that I can persist, that I can do hard things, that I can take on challenges, maybe as a professional that would have been intimidating. And it also, I think, gives me patience with other people and with some of those tasks that I have to complete that maybe are less desirable than some of the more fun aspects of my job. And I think that, in a way, it maybe helps make me a more reflective person and look for the connections in my own storytelling that I see in my running.
So you've done this. You've done everything before it. What in the world is next?
What's next is I'm not running for a little while. I'm enjoying some downtime and to the extent that I can call myself lazy, being lazy. And I don't know. I think I have to evaluate. I think I would run 100 miles again, which I wasn't sure going in. I thought this could be my one and done. I won't ever need to do this again. And I still don't need to ever do it again. But it might be fun to go back to that race and improve my time now that I know the course a little bit better and I've had some practice on it. But I think I'm comfortable in the 50-mile range, so I'll probably find some more fun 50-milers just to kind of mellow out for a little bit, but we'll see. I'm not... I know that I usually find new ways to challenge myself. I'm just not there yet.
And finally, if someone is listening to this, why should they get into the world of ultramarathoning, whether it's a 100-miler or anything over, for that matter, 26.2?
Sure. I think, you know, everybody approaches the sport for their own reasons and with their own goals and motivations. But, you know, I would say it's a really good way to meet good people who are passionate about running, are passionate about the outdoors, who are interested in challenging themselves in new ways, but in also helping other people challenge themselves. So, you know, I would encourage people to do it to find that community and to really learn more about themselves, to dig deep and learn what they're made out of and in ways that maybe you don't find in other aspects of life.